This is the Black Chisel Podcast. Real people, real experiences, real resilience. Let's get the party started. Let's get straight into it. Brent, how are you, my brother?
Morning, Clay. I am very well, thank you. And yeah, excited to be here. I'm glad my name got attached to the camera before it was just saying unknown person.
No, it says unverified. It's unverified, it says. We run pretty tight protocols here. We're like the CIA, to be honest with you. We don't just let anyone log in. It's probably easier to... I'll be honest with you, the way we run IT here, as far as security goes, it would probably be easy to log in with the CIA or the FBI. Mate, I reached out and asked you to join us. But ultimately, we're talking about someone that's a Paralympian. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we go through, just about current affairs and what you thought of the recent Paralympics. As well as a world record holding triathlete. And there's a bunch of other stuff you've done in there as well. You've got an awesome sister. I tried to get her on again, but she's too expensive. I mean, you do pro bono gigs, and she turned around and said, mate, tell your story walking. I'm not really interested. Being the staunch creature that she must be, I've got to meet this young lady one day. But yeah, we're very privileged to have Brent once again return, being an Olympian, being an individual that's just remarkable and you know, lives an incredible life, and a man that's had sort of things go against him from an early day, but that hasn't even stood his way in any shape, form or other. Morning, mate.
G'day, yes. So excited to be here again, and yes, so apologies about the sister. She's definitely... let the fame go to her head.
The fame of being an incredible cancer survivor through the early aspects of her life and through to adult life and everything else. I mean, just remarkable. I mean, it was an emotional piece you shared last time, not from your perspective because you're so accustomed to it, but I can tell you from my perspective and many people that I bumped into and chatted with, they were just, you know, what do you say? That was just remarkable. As well as your good self, mate. I mean... I need to address the elephant in the room straight up, Brent. I know that you're comfortable with this. It's part of what makes you a great role model to so many. But the Paralympic aspect of your good self was the fact that when you were a young man, a robot or a bear chewed your leg off. Is that correct?
No, it was, I lost it bungee jumping. One leg slipped out and it just yanked the other one off is the story that I go with.
I like it. I love it.
Or saving lives.
Mate, just, I mean, I often, like I said to you before, and I bump into people often and, you know, they're battling something and they sort of put some sort of clinical scientific spin on it or some sort of level of, you know, trying to make comfort with it or societal acceptance. And I've said, mate, you got to come up with a better story than that shit. You know, it's got to be it was chewed off or I was attacked by a shark or I was fighting zombies or whatever else. I mean, I do that all the time. I mean, the stroke that I had, mate, I talk about being shot in the head, you know. You can't let the truth get in the way of a good story, right, at the end of the day.
No, and one of the things about being, I guess, an above-knee amputee and the fact that I wear shorts every day is that everyone sees it. And so if I'm in a public space, the amount of times that I could get asked daily about what happened to my leg, especially from children, right, so I just have this plethora of opportunities to go as wild and creative as I want.
100%.
And I think if I didn't have that fun, that it could be draining. You know, you need to be able to play with it and enjoy it. Otherwise, it could just become a bit monotonous.
Well, mate, the thing about having some fun. I mean, you know, I always say to people, don't take this life too seriously. We're not going to get out of alive anyway. You know, like we talk about resilience, we talk about stress, which we're going to lead into today. I mean, at the end of the day, humor's a great part of our acceptance and our survival, right? Like, I mean, there's times where, like, one of my quotes that I learned years by going with my son in the professional sporting realm was where he failed in a nationals that was favored to take home in this particular year, and someone just very calmly said, mate, well, you win or you learn. And I know that's become, you know, well-known sort of quote in more modern time, but I thought that was really cool at the time. And I built off that and I created a model that I use in resilience, which was you win, you learn, or you laugh. Because sometimes, like, yep. What do you do with that, mate? It's a Seinfeld moment. What do you do with it, mate? It is what it is, mate. The universe dished it up. So it's a great piece, mate. And look, just on the kid bit, I mean, I don't like kids. Kids are horrible little things. They've got claws and poisons and sharp teeth and all sorts of shit. I'm not a kid fan. I mean, but if it was me and they asked me the question, I'd say, mate, if they said, what happened to you? You know, what happened to your leg or whatever it be? Mate, I didn't eat my vegetables or I wasn't good to my parents or something. You'd have to torture the kid so they didn't sleep of the night. Give one back to them, mate.
Mate, I haven't actually gone that angle before.
Mate, what's going on? No excuses being your business. And when I say no excuses, yeah. If you want to look it up, people, really cool website. It's No Excuses, spelt with a capital X and then C-U-S-E-S, as opposed to the traditional way. I like it. Cool website. Actually, there's a piece there that I really like that talks of, where is it here? No excuses. Master adversity, unlock potential. You know, really cool pieces. Really good stuff, resilience, leadership, all the above, mate. So there's a little plug for your business and what you do and obviously a lot of great feedback and everything else that goes with. So awesome, mate. How's the business going?
Yeah, look, going really well, right? I mean, one of the things about what I do, it's been a journey to think that, you know, this was something that I started on a trajectory in 2013 where I went from being in IT in a corporate position in a massive company in the city to then having my perspective just slightly shift day by day to like, what else could I do and how far could I push it? And then to, you know, go on the journey that I went on and set the world record in the Ironman, debut the sport of triathlon in the Paralympics, and then speak around Australia and obviously in New Zealand as well. Like, it's just so surreal when I look back over what's now, what are we? So it was 2013, like 11 years, right? That's gone in the blink of an eye. And so, you know, just as an example, the other week, maybe it was 2 weeks ago, I got asked to go and speak at a primary school because there's a kid there that was born missing the bones in his lower limb, so he became an amputee.
Yep.
He's a six-year-old, so same age as my son, and so yeah, they wanted me to go and present at the school and be able to give the other kids their perspective that he's just like everyone else and he's going to be able to do incredible things and, you know, basically stop focusing on the fact that he had one leg. And but also, 3 months prior to that, there was a 15-year-old that lost his leg. And again, you know, I had the pleasure of presenting to the school, hanging out with both those kids and their parents afterwards and just talking about what life could be. And the fact that they're now presented with this amazing opportunity to do some incredible things if they choose to do it.
Mate, that's incredible. Mate, wow. You know, I was just thinking as you said that as well. I mean, if it was me and I went to a school and had to sort of speak in regards to that, I probably would have removed my carbon fiber leg and threatened the kids and said, if you bully this kid, mate, I will hurt you. I will find where you live. I will haunt you. So there's a reason I haven't really been invited to speak to schools.
Yeah, it's not a common request for you, I can tell you.
No, okay. It's not on the brochure. Mate, let's get the party started. Let's talk about it. You know, when I spoke to you yesterday and we had a chat, you know, we've done this green juice thing in recent time and it's been a really strong theme and it's been a really theme around the resilience piece, which I'm still a massive promoter, advocate and everything else of. But the piece that I'm interested in a little bit at the minute is stress. And ultimately, there's a lot going on, as there always is, in people's lives, in this world and in people's workplaces, including this one here. But stress, you know, like just to set the context a little bit for everyone that's listening, you know, looking at the World Health Organization's definition or how they define it, because we've all got different definitions of different things, ultimately they talk of a state of worry or mental tension that is caused by a difficult situation. They say that it's a normal human response that prompts us to address these challenges and threats in our lives. Now, I become very word particular around things, so if I break things down a little bit, so it's a state of worry. That gets my attention first and foremost. Add to that, you know, mental tension, great, twisting the brain, whatever it be, caused by a difficult situation. And the reality is we're always going to find difficult situations. But this second part gets my attention. You know, I always say to people, God somewhat overestimated his ability when he made human kind, right? At the end of the day, we're not perfect. And I say to people repetitively, my team would know this, we're just human, right? So it is a natural human response, but it's there to prompt us to address challenges and threats in our lives. And if you look at Yerkes Dobson's law or theory of stress, I don't know if you've ever seen that, it's suggesting that we need a level of stress to perform to our optimum. Not enough, we become very apathetic. We lie on the beach and life is bliss, so to speak. Too much, and we burn out. So based on that little intro, just for the context, if I said stress to you, talk to me about what stress means to you and what it looks like for you.
Well, firstly, I think there's two parts to it, right? So one is, and I mean, I don't know if you ever do this, Clay, but like I'd be curious to know what is the first word to everyone here on this call when they think of stress. What's something they would use to describe that? Like, what is one word, right, as a default?
That's a good question. That's a good question.
Yeah. So, I mean, if they want to pop it in the chat, I'd love to get everyone's kind of first thing that pops into their mind when they think of stress.
Let me just get the little chatty bit gum up, because where are we? Because I've got a lot of things popping up at the moment. Brandon, I've been out of the game for a while, mate, to be honest with you. I've been, you know, I've got Will Diaz telling me there's a movie where Ricky Gervais does exactly that, but with a hammer.
So we were talking about fun before, right? Yeah. And laughing. And so I reiterate the fact that I believe that incorporating as much laughter in your life as possible, right, is a huge tool for stress and resilience. And in fact, so much so that I define my two core values as growth and fun, right? And I know that I need to have both of those things in my life to feel like it's on track. And so Ricky Gervais is one of my things that I do to go to sleep. I'll listen to his old podcast with Carl Pilkington night and just giggle as I fall asleep. And so it's funny that he was mentioned in the comments.
I like it. Well done to you, Will. Now, here we go. Oh, that was before, guys, so I think he was threatening me. I don't know. But anyway, here we go. Here's some feedback for us straight up. I've got from the wonderful super coach to the stars, Greg Cream, fear. From Bill, I've got challenge. From Jesse, I've got challenge. From Will, I've got an apology for threatening me. With Travis, I've got irritability. I like that. Kelsey, I've got fatigue. I like that. Kutsi's put anxiety. Raymond, pray. Sanjay, it's a state of inability being able to deal with challenges. Ryan, he's come up with a challenge. Will's come up with uncertainty. Will just keeps popping up. Eric's come up with unease. And I like this, Kelsey. Look at you go. It's a state of fight or flight. You've stolen me thunder. You're taking over, Kelsey, because we're going to talk fight or flight as we go through. So just to do those again for you quickly, Brant, we've got fear. We've got challenge. We've got irritability.
I've got them up there as well.
You've got them? Fantastic, mate.
Yeah. So I've read through. So yeah, that's really good. So then I think this is from my experience, right? So speaking on my experience, I think there's then two stages. There's the stage of stress when it's affecting your sleep. And if it's consistently affecting your ability to sleep, then there's some type of intervention that needs to happen, right? You're going to have to get some professional help, or at least then try the other stuff to see if that helps. But that's kind of like the definition of when it's becoming to a point where it's damaging, is if it's affecting your ability to sleep. And then the second part of that is, as a culture, typically I see a few people here that defined it as challenge, right? I'd be interested to know their background and I guess experience and education. But typically as a culture, all of our definitions for stress are negative, right? Every one of them is about how stress affects us in a negative way. And the science and the research shows that if we can shift our frame in which we view stress as basically flipping it from the cultural negative norms that we have to then defining it as a state getting us ready to face something that's difficult, right? In terms of it, the similarities between excitement and stress from a physiological impact on the body, right? Yeah. We talk about narrowing of focus. We talk about all these bodily functions that are basically getting us ready to do something, but in a very, very focused way. And if we can teach ourselves and reframe the language that we use, that this state is getting us ready to do something difficult, then the actual impacts on the body enhance us to do that thing rather than the flip side of that and focusing on how it's going to affect us negatively, which then reinforces it. So the story that we're telling ourselves directly impacts how stress affects our body.
I love it, mate, because I actually did a little bit of a Google this morning, and the quote that I like is a powerful quote. It says, "It's not stress that kills us. It's our reaction to it." And that was quoted by a gentleman named Hans Seel. He's a Hungarian-Canadian, and he's an, I'd never get this right, he's an endocrinologist. Yeah.
Okay.
Do you know what an endocrinologist is? Because I do. No. I do, and Sanjay does because he's chat-GPT-ing it right now. But an endocrinologist really studies the endocrino system, which is that of our glands and our organs, which produces our hormones and everything else. So they work with people with thyroid issues and all sorts of things like that. But old Hans was the originator and a bit of a granddaddy of, a master of. He's passed away, sadly, but he was a granddaddy and master of the theory of stress. And he spoke about that. But I think that quote is incredible, and it sort of dovetails nicely into what you just sort of spoke about, was it's not the stress that kills us, it's our reaction to it. And I would add to that, it's how we perceive it, because like we said, or you've just highlighted, that for most, we perceive stress as a bad thing. Whereas stress is something we need. It's something that moves us. It's something that gets us going. But Kelsey picked up on it earlier, and well done to her. The fight or flight response is, you know, I often speak to people about fight or flight, and people just have an assumption, oh, yeah, fight, flight, whatever else. But flight is very handy to us and very helpful for us, as is fight. But fight isn't naturally just spears come up. It might be how we adapt to things, how we adjust to things, how we challenge things, whatever it be. So I like what you just started there. And in Yerkes Dobson, as I said, the Yerkes Dobson law, which I promote quite a bit, is understanding that we need an optimum level of stress for an optimum level of performance. So talk to me about your career as a Paralympian, a triathlete and everything else. You naturally had the fight or flight response like everyone else. You naturally had the threat response like everyone else. You had the anxiety like everyone else. You would have the mood swings like everyone else. How did you manage your stress?
Yeah, look, it's a fantastic question. I think one of the things that, I don't know if I said this last time, but originally, I don't own this this quote, but originally heard it from David Goggins, who's not everyone's cup of tea, but he's obviously a very hardcore endurance athlete and hardcore mentally tough, right?
Intense is a good way to describe Mr. Goggins.
Yeah, intense and also very American, you know, in terms of that.
Yes.
Like, hurrah and yeah.
Well, he's an Navy SEAL, right? So,
yeah, exactly. And so one of the things that he said, and it just really resonated with me, was that endurance sport is like a sped up testing ground of life in terms of how quickly you'll face challenges and have to overcome them, and that cycle of being able to do that again and again and again. And I couldn't agree more. I think I got two goes at it, right? Growing up as a one-legged kid and also then going into endurance sport meant that I had many opportunities to practice trying things, failing, and then having another go, adapting. And that was just my norm. I got to do it many, many more times than most because of what I had to adapt through my entire life. But when I think of stress, I don't think I've obviously had the financial stress and the family stress, but at its highest level, I can't go anywhere else than race day morning at the Paralympics in Rio de Janeiro. So if you think of the fact that you've trained every day of your life, like every day for the last 4 years for one single moment that is an hour long, realistically. And anything, any mistake that's external is game over, but anything that happens in the race that you do wrong is also pretty much game over. And so, but as a as an athlete, I think it's almost by default, it's this, you've trained 4 years for it. So it's, you're almost naturally, at least me anyway, you're framing it as excitement, right? Like everything is getting you ready.
Yeah.
You've also, another piece that I believe in helping you from a stress point of view is preparation, right? And naturally as an athlete, you've spent the last, your light's going on again, Clay.
Oh, mate.
And so I know preparation obviously builds that confidence, and then it can help with stress. And then lastly is the visualization part. So if we were to think race day morning, I'm in Rio, right? So then, well, let's go the night before. So the night before, and I don't know if I told this story last time, but so feel free to let me know if I did. But the night before the race, me and a teammate, so another Australian athlete, we're in our hotel room on Ipanema Beach, right, ready to race on Copacabana Beach in Rio. And we were joking, like having a conversation, basically telling each other how relaxed we'd been the whole lead up into the games and, you know, basically bragging to each other. He then went to sleep and then I stayed up the entire night. Mm. I could not go to sleep. Yeah. I was just laying there awake. And then it comes to race day morning, I can't eat a single piece of food because I'm just going to throw it instantly right back up. And then we're standing on Copacabana Beach and they make us swim 200 metres before the race, to swim 200 metres offshore to the pontoon. But as we're waiting there, one of the things that I found that really helped is visualisation. So I'm sitting on the ground just moments before my race, I'm closing my eyes, I'm relaxing, and then I'm going through every element of the race of what I've got to do next, right? I'll close my eyes and I'll visualize every single incident and step that will happen to make this race go from start to finish. And that mental almost checklist of going through everything that I'm about to do or needs to be done to get to the finish line was something that really calmed me down and gave me confidence that I was ready to start. I knew that I'd taken care of every detail because I'd rehearsed it, and it only takes moments in your head. And then, you know, you get out and swim to the pontoon and the race begins.
The thing I was thinking of is just... No, look, and I've explored that before myself, and I know in a sporting playground that's quite a pertinent piece, and there's also visualisation tools that you can get out of a mate of mine that was a pro fighter, and he had something from the US, these particular goggles that he wore and everything else. So I don't know, visualisation is a big piece. But my concern when I hear that, and I understand it in a sporting context, I understand it in a lot of contexts, but my concern, I guess, sitting here and knowing the audience that I've got and the environmental factors that we have and everything else, my concern would be that people would confuse visualisation with rumination, right? And what I mean by that is that one of the issues that I deal with on a regular basis here and speak to people, and I'm guilty as charged from a good self, that people will talk about, they think about work all the time in their sleep, or they wake up thinking about work and everything else, and it's got a negative consequence to that because you have a disrupted sleep and you're hurting yourself in the process. So your take on that, what's the difference between, say, the visualization and the risk of rumination and getting into a negative loop?
I guess from my experience, if I was in that context, I reckon that it would be combining this visualization. So it's almost, I'd say it almost being a moment of reflection and mindfulness, right? So basically slowing down, stopping, and then I'd be going through that visualization process and combining that with one of these tools that I love to use, right? And I'd love to get your input on it, what you think the value is in it, mm-hmm. in your space. But basically, it was this really, really simple tool of getting a piece of paper, drawing a line down the middle, and basically listing out everything I can control about this current scenario, challenge, adversity I face, and everything that I can't control about this current situation that I face. And so basically just brainstorming. So that the reflection is to be able to identify that, see what the problem is, and then list out every single thing that is in your mind about those two scenarios, and then look at the can't control side of the column. Acknowledge everything that's there and that it sucks. And so we're talking, you know, like external factors, COVID, whatever it is, right? And so basically acknowledging everything on that, acknowledging that it sucks, and then making the conscious decision that you can't do anything about it. So any energy that's spent in that can't column is wasted. It's wasted energy past that point. And then what I do is I then prioritize the can control in terms of, and you can do this two ways, right? You can go for greatest impact on how this is going to improve or help my situation. Or if you're overwhelmed, then you can go for quick wins to build momentum before you take on a more significant to-do item, right? So depending on what you need to do and where you're at, you make a decision, right? Do I do the easy quick wins so I can build confidence and build motivation before I tackle the big stuff? Or am I looking to make the most amount of impact in the shortest amount of time, and then let's focus on the biggest one that I can control?
Love it, mate. I love it. I mean, the piece that, you know, I speak to all the time, and the coaches work to, and it's part of our toolkit, I guess, is that piece, that dichotomy of control piece. Which in modern psychology we call it that ILOC, which is that internal locus of control, that internal locus of concern. But take it back to the dichotomy was that of Stoicism, as we know, and in the philosophies associated, it was actually Epictetus, which was Epictetus in Greek, actually means acquired. And Epictetus was a slave. And I don't know if you know the story of Epictetus, but he was a slave, he was acquired. And he was brutalized by his owner, if you want to call it, for want of a terrible term. And he was brutalized to the point that he actually ended up with a permanent limp and disability because of the torturous behavior inflicted upon him. And he was one of the great philosophers of Stoic practice and Stoic philosophy. And he was the one that introduced us to the dichotomy of control and not giving up the complete agency to external factors, which is a powerful piece. So I love what you just suggested, because it just helps reiterate and validate the work that we do with people around. Let's just frame this up, and there are some good little toolkits, and yours is just a great simple one. I love it. I've got really accustomed to writing things out and meaning, draw a line down the middle of a page, and one side what can I control, another side what can't I, because it's that rational thinking. And when we explore those kind of things, that we can remind ourselves against, as opposed to, unfortunately, where when we're in an irrational state, we're very quick to just go into that fight or flight response or that irrational thinking, which results in us just, you know, the emotions take control of us and not the good emotions. So I like that, mate. That's a really powerful piece for us. Brent,
I think it helps with that rumination side too, Clay, right? Like if you've written it down, you've kind of acknowledged it and you can, and then kind of park it. And I think that the powerful piece with this is that it's simplicity, right? It's really easy to do. It doesn't need anything. You don't need to have a deep understanding of the theory behind it, but also just the process of doing it can actually shift your well-being, because you start to think, there is something that I can do in this scenario, rather than the ruminating, focusing on all the negatives, and then just actually being overwhelmed and not believing that you have any way forward, right?
Yeah, well, that's personal sovereignty, isn't it? At the moment, we give up complete control. I mean, I have individuals, and look, guilty as charged. I'm not judging anyone, but I'm guilty as charged myself. We have those moments where we sit here and we play the victim, if you like, and it's all, you got to understand if I had more resources. You got to understand if they listened to me. If you got to understand my boss wasn't this, you know, I'd be able to do these things. And all that's doing is giving up one's personal sovereignty. We're giving control to external factors, which is our, and when I say sovereignty, that's our freedom, our personal freedom of choice. You know, if you don't, if where you work is the bane of your happiness, the bane of your existence, make a choice. Now, I get it's not as easy as just packing up and running a yoga studio, but at the end of the day, make a choice, mate. You know, make some choices that are productive for yourself. So I love that, mate. Now, Brent, when I look at you, I see typical of what you see in incredible amateur sportsmen like yourself in professional playgrounds and vice versa, you know, you live this rock star lifestyle, this gangster lifestyle. It's just one of cash, fancy cars, you know, people throwing themselves at your feet, showering you in cash, expensive stuff that you buy. I noticed before I saw something flash and I think it was a diamond or something that was on the end of your pencil, whereas I've just got a poorly chewed out pencil that I've been holding on to. That aside, how does Brant realise that, mate, you're just human, I've got a family, I've got financial concerns, I'm trying to make a business that works. It's easier, I believe, and only an opinion, and you know, being in a sporting playground, not to your level of performance, but it's easier sometimes to say, yeah, but this is sport, right? As opposed to this is life. And it's a fine line, I get that, but I mean, how do you deal with life stresses, so to speak? It's to do with their loved one, it's now to do with finances, it's now to do with that kind of things. Do you use the same practices that you used in sport in life, or do you use a slightly different toolkit?
Yeah, look, great question. And I think that one of the things that's, I don't know if it was just developed over time, but you talked about it before, being human, right? And I have this heightened awareness that we are all flawed in many different ways. And I think that acceptance of understanding that we are flawed and that we have some massive blind spots and some massive weaknesses. And so I'm aware of those. And I think I've become more aware of them as the years have gone on by. And then understanding, you know, do I just accept that this is a weakness and that there's nothing we can do about it? Or is it something that I need to work on myself? Or is there something that I can get help with, right? In terms of find someone that can help me fill that gap, or at least support me in that gap or grow me in that gap. And so I'm always looking for that. I guess one of my most recent powerful lessons, and I don't know exactly how it came about, but in Adam Grant's recent book, I've just forgotten the name of it, but I think it's called Rethinking. Yeah, Rethinking. He talks about this moment in time where there was, a very smart person came to an event just to listen, and he approached him after, and he's like, oh, you know, why are you here? And he's like, oh, my mission in life is to be less wrong tomorrow. And I think that's been a really helpful piece for me, is like understanding even in my biggest strengths that I have, realizing that there's still so much to go or so much growth that can happen in those, and that awareness, this quest to be less wrong tomorrow is something that will always work in your favor. If you don't have the ego that you know everything and you're always right, it opens you, and I saw it in the chat, that weaknesses equal opportunities, yeah. Right? Like, it opens you to the fact that you're curious about everything, right? You rock up with this fascination because you know that there's always something that you can learn from everything that you encounter. And that's really how I approach life. Like, every conversation I enter into, I'm just searching for that piece of information that then makes me less wrong tomorrow.
I like it, mate. It's pretty full on. It gets you thinking, right? Like, that's, you know, like I quoted the piece last night in a conversation with my wife, and I said, you know, that piece, I said, I don't know where it originated from, and it was, God only deals to those that can handle it. And so I used the incredible tool that was introduced to me by Sanjay, because he just abuses it, being ChatGPT. And I actually found where it originates from, and my wife corrected me about 20 times because she's a good Catholic girl, and I mispronounced quotes from the Bible and everything else, because I'm not a religious man. It's just not something I was ever introduced to, but I'm just trying to find it here for a second. And someone, I apologize to anyone that is a staunch, devout studier of the Bible or other right now, because I'm going to mispronounce it again. My wife, she's crazy Portuguese, right? And at the end of the day, she threatened me with violence many a time when I mispronounce this, but Corinthians, 10.13 mm-hmm. is a verse from the New Testament of the Bible written by the Apostle Paul in his first letter to the Corinthians. Oh, there you go. I got it right for once. The verse reads, "No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear." And so the modern take on that is what it's suggesting is that, yes, we will face challenge. We will face hardship. But we will hopefully face them to a level that we are equipped to endure or bear, right? And so reverse or re-engineering that quote, for me, it is about making sure we've got the tools to face challenges of today. And I've said to many people in the business on many occasions, you know, what are the three common realities of this business or any life? And for me, it was we're going to endure problems. We're going to endure conflict, right? And so for me, and there was a third one there that just eludes me for the minute, it will come back into my head in a second, but the bottom line is, as a result of that, why would we not become skilled at those things? Because I often say to people, what's your problem-solving approach? What's your problem-solving model that you work to? What's your conflict management approach? What's your conflict education? Whatever it be, because you've sat here and openly agreed with me that conflict and problems are inevitable and we're going to face them. Well, what work have we done to prepare ourselves for those? And so that's an important piece for me, and I think it alludes to a little bit of what you've suggested earlier. So for me, I mean, what do you identify as realities in your world, and then what is the work that you do, not just the philosophies, but what are the work that you do to equip you for those challenges in a personal, or let's talk business, in a business sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So I can talk about a recent failure. So, I don't know how much I touched on this last time, but I was training for the Paris 2024 Olympics. Mm-hmm. And I had a very short runway because obviously Tokyo was delayed by a year, which meant there was only 3 years to Paris. We just had our second baby boy, Leo. And so I waited. He also, to reiterate what you were talking about before by them being little spawns of evil, he had acid reflux. And so the first year was just horrendous. Or let's say 6 months to a year. And so that was that moment, like that part of time just disappeared. And then I was like, okay, no, I'm going to do this. I'm going to commit to it. I talked to my wife. We'd mapped out what it was going to be. And then I said, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it properly, like with everything that I possibly can. And so I decided that what I believed was a great way to do that was to create my own board. So my committee that were business leaders that were going to help make this a reality, because in my experience, finance and financing that journey has always been the biggest challenge. And the reason being, if you want to do this with the quest of getting gold medal in the Paralympic Games, it can't be a side hustle. It needs to be everything, right? It has to be all in. And so I was like, all right, we need finances to be sorted. And so I created this board, and originally it was four members. So I had four members. And then it expanded to six members of business leaders and mentors. And so we met monthly and we talked about the goals and what we were going to do and get everyone's input and feedback. And I didn't realize it at the time, but like reflecting on it, it ended up being that whole, almost like that principle of committee, right? Where if you wanted a committee to design a horse, you'd end up with a camel. I think something along those lines is how it goes.
And say that again. You've got me attention now. We're talking about camels and horses. Talk to me again. What was that?
So I don't know the exact expression, and I don't know if Sanjay can chat GPT.
He will be onto it.
But it's basically if you got a committee to design a horse, you'd end up with a camel because of. But basically, they're talking about you know everyone's vision of what a horse would be different. The inability to effectively communicate and come up with a single focus. And I didn't realize it in the time, but looking back, it's basically what I believed would happen was we didn't achieve anything. We had massive, like some big organizations saying that they were going to, And they dragged it out to what ended up being 8 months and constantly told us that they were going to do it, and then they never did. And they ended up not raising a single dollar in terms of finances and having to pull out from the Paris 2024 Paralympics.
Okay, interesting.
And so this is something that I believe that I was really proactive in. I thought about it. I did well. Like, I thought I planned well. Yeah, I had a plan. Yeah. I had these very intelligent people that were well-connected. And then it failed. Oh, we've just seen it posted in the chat.
Yeah, he's onto it. He doesn't mess around, Sanjay. He's an incredible athlete. The other thing about Sanjay, the great athlete that he is, he's also highlighted, before we go on to that, just going back a little bit in the journey, endocrinologist Hans Seil's stress model talks of three phases: the alarm reaction, the stage of resistance, and the stage of exhaustion. So that might be something worth exploring for our good selves or anyone else that's listening in. But so what Sanjay got here from his ChatGPT account: a camel is a horse designed by a committee, an expression critical of committees, or by analogy, group decision-making, by emphasizing the ineffectiveness of incorporating too many conflicting opinions in a single project. So with your good self, one thing I want to say, and it's a digression, but the side note is, it's interesting, you know, when we talk of Olympic sports and everything else, and as you know, my lad's in that sort of playground as well, I quote it this way, you know, you're actually a professional in an amateur sport. That makes it very challenging, right? Because you're expected to be a professional and do everything to the most professional of levels. But then they say, oh, by the way, you got to self-fund all this. You know, so it's quite remarkable. I mean, he gets it all the time. Unfortunately, he's at the moment getting funded for a lot of things, but he doesn't get paid either. And they say, oh, listen, we just want you to realize. He's in Montenegro as we speak and doing a weight cut today. And at the end of that, I was, oh, we just want you to get a Montenegro next week and we need you to do this and that. But before you go, we want you to come over here to Melbourne and X, Y, Z. It's like, well, okay, who's funding all of this, you know? And yeah, it's a tough life for you guys. Like, mate, talk to me. Talk to me a little bit more. So, and I want, if anyone's got any good questions they want to ask in the stress playground, you know, so what we've summarized to this point, or what we've understood to this point, is that stress is a normal human response. Yes, it activates that of our fight or flight response, but that doesn't have to be a negative. That can be a very positive. The fight doesn't necessarily mean we're going to stab someone. The fight might mean that we're going to adapt to something, we're going to grow, we're going to face it, we're going to lean into it, all those great qualities of in that context. The flight can also be good, because sometimes it's things we just need to avoid it. We just need to move away from it. And for me, the flight component is an important piece. I recently made a decision, and a very junior decision in context of the world, I guess, but I've stopped doing something in my personal life, meaning going to an activity that I was going to with a bunch of people, like the activity, but I've realized that I'm not enjoying it. I've realized that it's more of a stress than a reward. I'm realizing that it's an unnecessary stress that I can eliminate through a very honest conversation, which virtually said to the person, loved it, but not really into it anymore. And the relief that came off the back of that. So I guess it's a statement, but I guess at the same time, is there things that you decide in your world, Brand, from time to time, you know what, I'm going to fly it. I'm just going to cut it out because it's just unnecessary.
Yeah, absolutely. So I completely agree. I think as a culture, well, I believe as a culture that we are typically bad at saying no, right?
Yeah.
It's, again, most of us avoid conflict and avoid difficult conversations typically, again, right? This is a general rule, but the ability to say no to stuff that doesn't align with your goals and your values, I think is hugely beneficial. And I am very controlled in terms of what I do, right? I have a very small social circle in terms of people that I'd hang out with. My goals really now, since missing out on Paris, is financial stability for my family, right?
Yeah.
That's the main thing, is I just want to take care, because when you go to do what I do, you kind of put that stuff aside and you're taking step back financially typically. Yeah, so the ability to say no to anything that's basically not aligned with that goal, it gives me more space to do that. I just want to reiterate what you spoke about before in terms of the stress. I agree. Like before, at the beginning, I told you I think that there's a level of stress which talks. I don't know the guy's name that you said, but that exhaustion part I think is when it creeps into the fact that it's affecting your sleep. And I also don't. I believe that you also get. So there's growth mindset, but then there's this stress enhancing mindset, which is what we talked about by reframing it. That is again like both. These are abilities that you can get better at to handle more of it. Does that make sense?
Say that again. Say that again for me. Talk to me like I'm six.
So with growth mindset, again, it's a skill that you get better at. So you can take on bigger challenges and you can walk away with those, with loads of learnings. The same with stress. You have a stress tolerance. And so some people have a higher stress tolerance and some people have a smaller stress tolerance, but you can develop that stress tolerance by practicing, like we've spoken about up until this point, putting yourself in those stressful moments, reframing that it's working for you in a smaller scale, get used to that, and then build it up so that you can handle more and more stress in that healthy range rather than tipping it over to that exhaustion range.
Yeah.
But that means that you then have to proactively practice this, because none of us know when the next massive or significant stress milestone is going to come around the corner.
Like, well, I guess if we did, it wouldn't be stressful, right? Yeah.
The next thing that's going to knock us on our ass, but we get to proactively practice these things. And that's why we come back to, like, you know, endurance sports, but even just having a challenge. I think you should always have a challenge that you've selected to focus on so that you can practice these skills, building your stress enhancing mindset and practice building your growth mindset.
Mate, I love it, you know, and it's just, I've been scratching down on my pad and making so many bits of, you know, reference. So I'm going to go back to the ability to say no. And it's such a challenge for humans because we don't do well with rejection, right? And we're also people that want to, as a race, we want, you know, to people please, you know, and we've all got that quality within us, some more so than others, right? And so people struggle to say no. And like I say to people quite often, it's not, the challenge is not saying no, it's the skill of being able to, how you say no, right? And sometimes it needs to be very direct. It needs to be a no. I'm out. I'm checking out. It's not for me anymore. Other times it might need to be a bit more tactful than that. But built off that, I just drew a little model for myself. I learned this years bygone, and the question I had to be asking myself, which I did just recently, was, is it giving me energy or is it taking energy away from me? So is that relationship, is that engagement, or whatever it be, like, I've said this, I think, previously on a podcast, so I apologise if I've said it, you know, and people listening have heard it too many times, but, you know, I once had a friend, and he was hard work. He was just hard work, and every time the phone rang from him, or a message came through, my brain just straight away went into a mode of, oh, what excuse can I come up with? How do I get out of this? Everything else. Because it was just challenging to go out with. Now, the thing about it was the bias, the human quality in that brain of ours, I would say, yeah, but I played many a season of football with him. He was in the trench with me. He was at my wedding. He was a great guy. You know, he's just got some challenges in his life. He's this and he's that. And you make all this justification for your relationship with them. But I needed to turn around and say no. And I didn't actually say no directly because it didn't require that. It just required stop saying yes. You know, stop saying, yeah, I'll meet you. I'll stop meeting you at such and such and catching up. And slowly but surely the relationship just faded out. But that was where my first experience of learning, is it giving me energy, is it taking energy away from me? And it was just exhausting. Whereas I want, you know, the phone rings and you know, I get the phone call from Brent and I'm all excited. I want to pick that phone up. And he says, listen, let's go for a run in the Lamborghini up the freeway and let's go and have a lobster lunch somewhere. I'm energized. I mean, I like lobster. So I take that from it. And then I really pick up on your point. Proactively practice. I really pick up on that point. And that just reminds me straight away of exposure therapy. You know, like you don't have to go straight out and put your hand in the face of the CEO of the organisation, so to speak, and say, nope, not doing it. But it might mean I find low risk, safer opportunities to start practicing the ability, as an example, to say no, to put in place a boundary, if you like. So that, that was really great.
Kalei, I'll add to that.
Please.
Which one of the things, I almost call it like the parent response, right? Like why don't you just start by implementing that everything is a no to begin with, right? Because I'm sure you've had this conversation with your kids as they were growing up, like you get into this parent stage where you just know that you're going to get asked something and the default answer is no. And kids know that the default answer is no. And then it's about them convincing you to make it a yes. I think for simplicity's sake, you say no, which then just gives you a moment to pause and then decide if this is, and you don't have to directly say no, but you get basically allowing a moment of space to then actually weigh up whether this is something that is adding value or taking away, right? I think that little giving yourself, by making it automatic, giving yourself a breathing, you get a chance to assess if this is something that is truly worth my time or not.
Mate, I like that. That's very good.
Mm.
Brian, my light's just come on. When you said that, I liked it, and it's like with stage, the light just came on above me, and it was like, wow, a light just came on for me, symbolically and mentally. Mate, what I want to do, Brian, something different. I mean, it's not different, I guess, but it's just being a bit more generous to everyone that's listening in, and to be mindful of your time because I know you're a busy man, but I want to pull it up at this point because I could talk to you all day and I could go down rabbit holes all day, and we're going to continue on this journey. I'm sure you and I are having coffee in here next week. So if anyone wants to catch up and meet Brian in person, come to my office, give me $8 a ticket, I've got this thing about $8. Every time my son asks me something, my wife asks me something, I said it'll cost you $8. I don't know where it came from, but I'll sell some tickets. I'll make some cash for myself. But if anyone would like to meet you next week too, come and see me, and I'd love to introduce you to Brant, shake a hand and get to know him. But what I want to do now is, in the last 5 minutes, open it up. Someone's surely got some questions they'd like to ask you, and rather than listen to me waffle on and deal with my lighting issue, people, what do we got? I know I've dropped it on you pretty quickly, but questions for Brant.
Also, Clay, do you mind if I share that link to that community that I was looking to build online? So rather than my website, for them to go to that.
I'd love you. And you know, I'd love you to be able to share whatever you can, mate, because, look, you and I have spoken, and hence why we're having coffee next week. You know, we've got to build that tribe. We've got to do a bit more stuff, right? So please, mate, share that link. That's given everyone the opportunity to start to think. And I'd love to hear a question come your way. And people, questions, you know, throw something out there. Don't be afraid to throw something out there. Benefit and utilise the opportunity that we've got in front of us before we dive back into another Friday before a long weekend. Has anyone got anything they want to ask?
Yeah, and again, right, if you don't want to ask this on a public forum, then you can always join that community that I'm starting. And you know, ask me there, ask me privately, ask me publicly. I approach every conversation with intense curiosity as an opportunity to grow.
What Brant just said then, that pretty much sounds how I deal with you guys on a daily basis, without judgment, generosity and the rest of it. Questions for Brant, people, what do we got? Someone throw something out there, or just say a thank you, whatever it needs to be.
Morning, Clay. Morning, Brant. Hey, lads. So I was a bit late to this one, so if it's been answered before, I'll go back and just watch the replay. But I've got one for you, Brant. I'm just curious, mate. I gave the Ironman triathlons a couple of years. The first year I went in, didn't get the result I wanted, and it started a fire in me to go back and absolutely flog myself to get the result I wanted. Ultimately, I got it, but there were a lot of sacrifices along the way. And I guess for a high-performing athlete, like, you know, you've gone and delivered on the results and really made a name for yourself. The biggest thing I found that was challenging was the prioritizing rest and recovery, so that I still had energy for my relationships, for work, for other items. And I don't know if you get it yourself, but obviously triathlon, it's three disciplines. It's a lot of time that goes into it. I just really struggled with actually prioritizing rest and recovery when you've got this goal that you want to achieve, and you know that aerobic base builds so rapidly that there's not enough hours in the day. You know, you could run 24 hours for a training session just about. So I'm just curious how you overcame the challenges of rest and recovery when you feel like, oh, I could be doing another hour or another 20 Ks or, you know, another 50 laps in the pool.
Yeah, look, fantastic question. And I think to be completely honest, the first thing I'd highlight is that when I did it in 2013, that I did it badly, right? So you talk about balance. There was no balance. It was only the Ironman, and I was incredibly bad at communicating. And it wasn't until afterwards that I understood, you know, the price that it took on those other elements within my life. And then it made me focus on the fact that when you're taking on something like this, or even just in life in general, right, that you always have life domains that are suffering at one point in time. And so I now consciously, because I get to facilitate this with organizations, which forces me to do it as well, I'll take a moment, I'll map out what they call this wheel of life activity, and I'll see which areas of my life haven't been getting the attention that they need, that are ranking lower than they should be. And then once I'm in a position to be able to do that, then I'll pivot to focus on those other things. So that's just more of a balancing everything, realizing that you can't, and that you have to rotate it to the stuff that's important to you, the stuff that matters. And then the second piece to that is prioritizing rest. I again, believe that that is a reframe, understanding that prioritizing rest, from my experience and from the conversations that I've had with coaches, support crew, and everyone, that in their experience and their opinion is that prioritizing rest was more important than most of those core training sessions as a one-off, right? So the fact that athletes that trained less, but recovered better, performed better than the ones that trained more, trying to cram in extra minutes because they felt they had to. They took care of recovery and nutrition as a first priority and then fitting in the training, they performed better.
Great stuff, Jeremy.
Oh, excellent. Thanks, mate.
Yeah, right, mate.
There's a Matt Burden podcast that was really good when he ran the Cairns one this year. That was a really great podcast. I don't know if anyone's had a chance to listen, but he essentially had infection all through his body. Had to take 6 weeks off, couldn't run for 6 weeks. And I think before the event, he had 2 weeks of training and then went out. I don't know if he broke the course record, but he won Cairns Ironman event. And, you know, he was 37 years old or however old he is. So it just kind of really flipped my perspective on rest and recovery in that sense.
Good stuff, Ryder. Now, Ryder,
is not going to improve your outcomes.
Do me a favor, Ryder. Find that link and put it up in the message board so we can have a look at that. And so appreciate that. Mate, before we wrap it up and to get it to this point very quickly, Raymond, an incredible individual and question here. What's the first thing, Brant, that you do to mentally prep for your day ahead? What's the first thing you do? You get out of bed, out of that and that palatial palace that you live in. What's the first thing you do to mentally prep for the day ahead?
Oh,
good question,
I'd say that, yeah, it's a great question, and I probably think that it's something that I need to give a priority that's kind of slipped more recently. But I guess I get the privilege of being the first up in my house, and I actually get my family ready for the day, right? So I get all the stuff ready for my wife and kids for them to tackle on the day. And it's just me by myself thinking about what I'm going to do for the day ahead, right? So it's like a mindful ritual experience mindful ritual. I have my coffee, right? So I love my morning coffee, and it's just me. So it's silent, and I just get to think about what I want to achieve that day while mindfully getting their stuff ready in the morning.
Brandon, I love that, mate. Thank you. All right, people, listen, we need to wrap it up there because Brant's a busy man. You're all busy people. Thank you very much to Brant. Thanks to all of you. Like I said, Brant's in next week having a coffee. He's put his link in there. Do me a favor, Brant, before we get you out of there as well, we'll whack your link in there from your No Excuses website as well. If not, I'll do that when we get off. Thank you again, mate. We're going to speak next week. Thanks to all of you to come back online. It's been a bit of a great stuff. People have an awesome long weekend. Be safe, be well, and put some of this into proactive practice. The words of Brent Gavry, right? So thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you very much, guys.